From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we celebrate the 40th anniversary of The Graduate. We'll hear from the film's star, Dustin Hoffman, its co-writer, Buck Henry, and director, Mike Nichols. We'll also hear from Paul Simon, who wrote the songs in the film. And our critic at large, John Powers, has some thoughts on viewing the movie again for the first time in 40 years. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews The Mist. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross.
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, I am.
Plastics.
It's been 40 years since that depressing advice was offered in the film The Graduate. On today's Fresh Air, in honor of that anniversary and the release of a new commemorative DVD, we're going to hear interviews Terry Gross recorded with four people behind the film The Graduate, starting with its director, Mike Nichols. The Graduate was one of the first films to depict the alienation young people felt towards their parents' generation in the 1960s. Dustin Hoffman starred as a college graduate who had returned, a bit aimlessly, to his parents' upper-middle-class suburban home. One night, after a party thrown by his parents in his honor, Benjamin is recruited to drive home Mrs. Robinson, the wife of his father's business partner. Mrs. Robinson, played wonderfully in the film by Anne Bancroft, convinces a reluctant Benjamin to come into the house. She puts on some mood music and gives him a drink.
May I ask you a question? What do you think of me?
What do you mean?
You've known me nearly all your life. You must have formed some opinion of me.
Well, I always thought that you were a very nice person.
Did you know I was an alcoholic?
What?
Did you know that?
Look, I think I should be going.
Sit down, Benjamin.
Mrs. Robinson, if you don't mind my saying so, this conversation is getting a little strange. Now, I'm sure that Mr. Robinson will be here any minute now.
No.
What?
My husband will be back quite late. He should be gone for several hours.
Oh, my God.
Pardon?
Oh, no, Mrs. Robinson. Oh, no.
What's wrong?
Mrs. Robinson, you didn't expect...
What?
I mean, you didn't really think I'd do something like that.
Like what?
What do you think?
Well, I don't know.
For God's sake. Mrs. Robinson, here we are. You got me into your house. You give me a drink. You put on music. Now you start opening up your personal life to me and tell me your husband won't be home for hours.
So?
Mrs. Robinson, you're trying to seduce me. Aren't you?
In a few minutes, we'll hear Dustin Hoffman talk about the role that made him a star. But first, let's hear from the man who cast him, director Mike Nichols, who won an Academy Award for directing The Graduate. When Terry spoke with him in 2001, she asked Mike Nichols about the most famous shot from that film.
The scene that this is from is the scene in which Mrs. Robinson, played by Anne Bancroft, is trying to seduce the young Dustin Hoffman freshly out of college. And the shot that I'm referring to is just as he's saying, Mrs. Robinson, are you trying to seduce me? She has been sitting on a bar stool. She's wearing a fairly short skirt. And as if in answer to that question, she has, like, raised her legs a little bit and separated them. She's, like, bent one of her legs. And you shoot Dustin Hoffman through that one bent leg. And that shot even became the shot used, or the image used, in the ad campaign.
Right.
Can you just talk a little bit about coming up with that shot?
Well, it was all about, that scene was all about him being stalked by Mrs. Robinson, you know, and we talked about it being a jungle, and it was a jungle. There was all these plants in the Beverly Hills garden that was, you know, behind the glass that surrounded this sun porch, and we talked about her being the tiger in the jungle, and she had a striped dress on, and tiger-striped dress on, and it was all built to be a trap, a tender trap. And then I wanted to just to find a way to express the fact that she was being extremely provocative and that he was framed by that provocativeness and that it was making him sweat. And there was her leg and it was up and it seemed logical, you know, to shoot through the arch of that leg.
And did you try it many different ways before coming up with just the right shot?
No, we just did that one shot. I mean, there it was. Anne put her heel up on the bar stool, and there was this very nice little arch through which you could see Dustin very well. And I said, oh, good, let's come over here. I like this. So, you know, things that become famous in movies are a concatenation of so many things that are out of control that have to do with the theme and with the way the theme strikes a time and a moment and people in their unconscious, all sorts of things that we don't control. But the process of choosing the pieces, the beads for the necklace that eventually gets thrown into the flames on the funeral pyre or that gets put on the princess as she's made into the queen, the process of making the beads, to try to abandon this metaphor as quickly as possible, is always the same. You know, you just look for the shot that most clearly expresses what's happening.
Mike Nichols, speaking to Terry Gross in 2001. His next film, Charlie Wilson's War, comes out next month. In just a bit, we'll hear from graduate screenwriter Buck Henry, but not before we listen to Dustin Hoffman, who visited with Terry in 1999. She asked him who gave him the best advice about acting in the movies.
Probably Mike Nichols in The Graduate, who told me almost every day two things. Three things. One was stop acting. Don't do.
I thought he meant get a new career. Well, he just meant tone it down, right.
He probably thought that. Uh-huh. But he would say, you're acting, don't act, don't do anything, because you are doing so much in front of a camera by not doing what you think is anything. I mean, you're on whatever it is, 70 feet of screen. You're already interesting. And the audience is doing a lot of the work for you, even. I mean, you don't have to do their work for them. And he said, if I did something he didn't like, he said, what did you do that take? And I would tell him, and he would say, why? And I would tell him the reason. And he would look at me, he says, oh, I get it. Okay, on this next take, when you get an idea in the middle of the scene, do the opposite. And that was really a smart thing to say. And then the third thing he did five or six times a day was tell me to clean the inside of my nose, which
is actually the most helpful.
Which has kept me on the marquee for giving all this long.
Now, is that important? Hasn't a good take ever been ruined by an embarrassing you-know-what in your nose?
Yes, but now with digital, they can just... It's costly,
really,
but they can take a lot of boogers out that they couldn't do.
Dustin Hoffman, 1968 was the year of The Graduate, and because of that movie, I think you were probably seen in part as a representative of your generation. And I was wondering what that experience was like for you.
You know, I was 29 going on 30, and I have a, when you mentioned that, I have a fixed memory of going to some, being invited to some college, because actually I went from an unemployed actor, actually someone on the unemployment line, to doing The Graduate, and suddenly I'm thrust into stardom, and the next thing I know is I'm supporting McCarthy for president and flying around the country with one of his daughters in a little airplane to all these colleges, trying to, you know, get votes for Eugene McCarthy, from an unemployment line to that in a few months. And I remember being in a college somewhere in the country and the kids kind of having this glaze in their eye of, oh, the new icon has arrived. And I systematically set out to kind of dethrone myself. And I said, guys, I just played a part. I'm an actor, and I'm not your age. I'm 30 years old, and that's just a guy I played, and it really has very little to do with me. I just wanted to be this actor, and I really wanted to avert the curse of being called a star.
Dustin Hoffman, recorded in 1999. After a short break, Buck Henry, who wrote The Graduate screenplay, will tell us about casting Hoffman for the role. He wasn't the type he and Mike Nichols initially had in mind. This is Fresh Air. We're devoting today's show to The Graduate, which has been re-released as a special 40th anniversary DVD. The screenplay for the 1967 film was written by Buck Henry, who adapted it from the novel of the same name. Henry co-wrote the TV spy spoof Get Smart with Mel Brooks, wrote the screenplays for Candy, Catch-22, and What's Up, Doc, and used to be a frequent guest host on Saturday Night Live. Terry spoke with him at the Film Forum in Manhattan in 1997 after the 30th anniversary screening of The Graduate.
You've said that when you were writing the screenplay, you saw the character of Benjamin as being a very kind of prototypically Southern California, blonde, surfboard kind of guy.
Yeah.
Not Dustin Hoffman.
Everybody.
It doesn't fit anything in that description.
We thought of all of them. Well, we used to call them the surfboards. And we thought of all of them as being big and blonde and Southern California. You know, that. I mean, there is a genetic thing that happens. I don't know how it happens, and I think science should investigate it, is that the darkest and most exotic Jews moved to Southern California, and in one or two generations, all the children are blonde and tall and blue-eyed. What happens? What is it? Sand gets in the genes. And so we thought of, and Charles Webb was tall and blonde and very prep school looking. So we thought of them all as being the blonde family. You know, ideally a Ronald Reagan, Doris Day, mother and father, and a Robert Redford, Candy Bergen, kids. And, of course, that fell apart as soon as we came around to really looking at actors doing it.
Wait, no. I understand you asked Doris Day, and
I didn't ask anybody. God knows.
Well, but she was approached.
But I think Larry and Mike asked Doris Day. I'm not sure. I think they did.
What about Ronald Reagan?
I don't know whether it ever got to him. And think how his life could have been made more meaningful.
That's right. Think how much different the country might have been.
There were a number of people. I know at one point Mike was thinking about Jeanne Moreau, which I think would have been wrong, although she would have been wonderful.
So when you saw Dustin Hoffman on the screen test, what made you think that even though he didn't fit at all your image of what this character should be, that he was right?
Yeah, well, it was there. The soul was there. And also he was... it's a great screen test. I think he did it with Catherine, and they're just terrific in it. It's really good, and you just see it. He just wiped everyone else out.
Did you see the character as being insecure and neurotic in the way that he is in the movie?
I don't remember anymore.
He supplanted what you had in your mind.
Yeah, you know, they become the thing you thought you'd invented but didn't really know was there. But it was so interesting. So then we rationalized it because we'd been talking about them as being surfboards for so long, we had to make up in our own minds what happened. So we said, okay, it's a genetic displacement. It's the other way around. He's a throwback to previous generations. And then around him were fit actors and actresses who really could do it. Not that there aren't blonde people who can do it. It just didn't have the same suption, as Faulkner would say, if he were here.
Now, how did Anne Bancroft get the part of Mrs. Robinson? She had not too long before The Graduate played the saintly and sacrificing Anne Sullivan in The Miracle Worker, the story of Helen Keller, and this is a long distance from that.
Well, she was a famous and loved actress.
She's wonderful.
And nobody ever... I mean, there was no question that she could do it and really do it. She was advised by everyone except Mel not to do it. At least that's the story they
tell. Were they married then?
Yeah.
She and Mel Brooks?
Yeah. And
now the funny thing is, like I read, she was in her 30s, I think about 36 when making the movie. And Dustin Hoffman, although he's playing 20 years old, was really 29. So that would mean their ages are, what, 7 or 8 years apart, which, I mean, lots of people have relationships with people 7 or 8 years apart. It's... And
but you have to buy him as being 21.
As being younger, right. But did they have to do anything to make him look younger and her look older so that they'd seem far apart, even though they weren't really.
Not to my knowledge. I mean, Dustin, well, you know, all male actors play younger than they are, inevitably. And I think Dustin is viable as being 21. I was amazed when I found out he was 30. I had some experience of Dustin in the theater. He worked in a theater I was playing in the early 60s, and then in the mid-60s, I went to this performance of a Ronald Rabe play called Harry Noonan Knight, a really strange and interesting play in which Dustin played, in which I saw this guy, I didn't recognize him, playing one of the three lead parts. He was playing a crippled German transvestite. And I, by the middle of the first act, I knew I was seeing a really weird theatrical thing because I realized that the producer had gone out and hired a crippled German transvestite to play this part. The accent was perfect. The limp was spectacular. And his transvestitism was completely convincing. So I'd seen Dustin do really amazing, at least one amazing piece of work, but I didn't know until I saw him do the test that he could do this too.
The most famous line in The Graduate is the line where one of the father's friends says, "I've just got one word for you, one word, plastics." That line struck a chord. I mean, it seemed to just kind of sum up everything that was false. You know, that people didn't want their lives, their futures to be part of.
Yeah, it seems so obvious now. It doesn't, you wonder why it took me more than 10 seconds, if indeed it did. I worried about plastics for a while and even talked to Mike about, are we too old-fashioned with plastics, which was sort of a 50s, 60s way of complaining about society's falseness. But I couldn't ever think of anything that was as interesting or more interesting, and or anything that wasn't a better word for them to say. Plastics is such a nice word. And the guy was so good who did it. The best thing about that was a few years later, I was watching television and I saw the scene come up, the party scene, except the actor didn't quite look like Dustin, and the actress sitting in the living room didn't quite look like Anne, but it was every shot all the way through plastics to the end of that piece, and then same photography, and then why not try the Peace Corps? And the Peace Corps had done an ad perfectly parodying the movie. I wish I had it. It was really a good piece of work.
I remember when I saw it, when the film came out, one of the things I couldn't imagine any of the men I know, any of the men I knew, any of my friends, sleeping with my mother's friends or with any of the mothers that we knew. It was just unimaginable to me. I think most of us saw our mothers as not being sexual. And so this was like a different world to me. Now,
well, they're two very
mother,
different things, sleeping,
yeah,
you know, sleeping with your mother's friends or someone sleeping with your mother. They're
right.
Loaded in very different ways.
Right. Now, I'm thinking your mother was a silent film star. She was a beauty.
An uncomfortable segue, but yeah. Yes.
But I'm thinking that you probably brought up in a world where women were very glamorous and very sexual.
There were many of my mother's friends I would happily have risked social approbation for.
So the sentiment in this movie rang true.
Oh, yeah.
Buck Henry speaking with Terry Gross. He'll be back in the second half of the show as our salute to The Graduate continues. Here's Buck Henry in a scene from the film, as Dustin Hoffman is checking into a hotel for his first rendezvous with Mrs. Robinson. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
A room. I'd like a room, please.
Single room or a double room?
Single, just for myself, please.
Did you sign the register, please? Anything wrong, sir?
What? No, nothing.
Do you have any luggage, Mr. Gladstone?
Luggage? Yes, yes, I do.
Where is it?
What?
Where is your luggage?
Well, it's in the car. It's out there in the car.
Very good, sir. I'll have a porter bring it in.
Oh, no. I'd rather not go to all the trouble of bringing it all in. I just have the toothbrush. I can get it myself. That's all right.
Of course. I'll have a porter show you the room.
Oh, well, actually, I just as soon find it myself. I just have a toothbrush to carry up, and I can handle it myself.
Whatever you say, sir.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble and the Barnes & Noble Review, the new online literary magazine with reviews, interviews, and recommendations. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and health care of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. And from the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, supporting educational, cultural, and environmental initiatives to make our world more livable. On the web at grdodge.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, more with Buck Henry on the film The Graduate. And we hear from Paul Simon, who wrote two of the most recognized songs in the movie. And John Powers answers the question, what's it like to watch The Graduate again after 40 years? Also, David Edelstein reviews the new film, The Mist. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley. We're celebrating the 40th anniversary of The Graduate, now out in a newly reissued DVD, by listening back to interviews with some of the show's collaborators. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Graduate screenwriter Buck Henry. Terry spoke with Buck Henry 10 years ago at the Film Forum in Manhattan. She asked him about the powerful final scene in the film. After Dustin Hoffman's character Benjamin Braddock is seduced by Mrs. Robinson, he falls in love with her daughter, Elaine. But Elaine goes off to get married. At the end of the film, Benjamin barges into the wedding and runs off with Elaine. They make their getaway on a public bus. But after a few moments of triumph and exhilaration, they stare blankly into space.
In the end of the film, it's kind of like a few beats after the typical happy ending. You know, they run away together, boy and girl get each other, real triumph. And then the camera just lingers longer on them than it normally would, and you see their faces drop in this like, uh-oh, what now? Expression come over. Did you know that that's the way it was going to end when you wrote the screenplay?
No. Well, let me lead you up to it. Nichols was always disturbed by the idea that in the book, Benjamin gets to the church in time to stop the wedding before the vows have been taken. And he always thought, it's too corny. It's like the cavalry coming in at the last moment. So we thought, well, let's let him get there after the ceremony is over and really wreak havoc. It isn't Christ's symbology when he's up there pounding on the glass. I mean, there's a guy in a church pounding on glass, so critics are inevitably going to make of it a Christ symbol, which it wasn't intended to be. Perhaps if he'd have pounded one-handed, things would have been different.
If there was blood coming out of the palms of his hands.
with a few scars. But that was not intended, and had we foreseen it, we might have done something differently, but probably not. And the cross, which I think was my idea, but I don't remember any longer. I just thought of it as, you know, a kind of vampire thing. Get back, you bloodsuckers. And then naturally sticking it in the door seemed the next logical thing to do. So they're running away, and they get on a bus, and they ride, and Mike had a long roll left on the film, and I don't remember him. I think he just didn't tell Catherine and Dustin anything in particular except sit down there and take a ride, and we'll see what happens. And, of course, what happened was they had nothing to say, nowhere to look, and so the sort of sense of, good Lord, what's going to happen next, which is a perfectly reasonable thing for the actors to feel, became part of the character and now has become this sort of legend in some people's minds who haven't seen it in the last few minutes, that the scene lasts for 10 minutes and they're sitting there and it's the, as I read in someone's critique of it in the last few days, it's a whole... It looks forward to the end of the 70s and the doom of that generation, blah, 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 blah.
Well, in the film world, I mean, I think it's fair to say now that a lot of producers aren't comfortable with ambiguous endings. And a lot of test audiences at the focus groups before a movie is released, they don't like unhappy endings. And a lot of endings nowadays are changed so that viewers get what they want, which is a happy resolution. There was no such thing in 67, 68 when this was coming out, right? You didn't have to test market it.
No, I don't think we did test market it. But also, well, there are two aspects of this that are interesting. One is that it tested, when it was first shown in theaters in previews, the audiences were receptive beyond any of our dreams. The other thing is that the opposite of that is when Mike showed it first to a kind of friends screening, it wasn't quite that respect. The audience wasn't quite that enthusiastic. I mean, they said, oh, it's terrific, it's funny, it's interesting to look at. The kid is weird, isn't he? It's a shame. He's so odd looking, big nose. So it's always, you know, you can't second guess from any particular group.
Any producer saying the ending's too ambiguous, you've got to
no, nobody ever said that. And also it is a happy ending with a little slice of lemon in it. I mean, it is perfect. He's got his girl and they've run away from the people that they're scared of and they're going to have either a long or a short happy life for a while. Who knows?
Did you know what was your guess?
No, I didn't know.
Okay. No, when The Graduate came out, I think it was still very uncommon to have actual records used instead of just a score written for the movie. So the Simon and Garfunkel records tie-in was very novel, and it was very successful. Mrs. Robinson rose to number one on the charts, and it really certainly helped Simon and Garfunkel's career a lot. Whose idea was it to actually use records?
Mike had... Paul's music in his head from the very beginning. I wasn't that familiar with it, but I listened to it a lot while working. He thought, well, Paul was going to write a whole new score, but Hello Darkness, is that what it's called?
Sounds of Silence.
Sounds of Silence. I think I'd know. Sounds of Silence, they put Mike and Sam Osteen, the editor, put Sounds of Silence onto the working track, and, you know, there was never anything that could replace it, finally. I think the only original song Paul wrote for it was Mrs. Robinson, which we all thought was cute and catchy, but hardly a world shaker, and, you know, there we are. I mean, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, what are they called, the Strawberries? Lemonhead, yeah, well, I was in sort of the right area. They did a really nice version of it.
Buck Henry speaking with Terry Gross at the Film Forum in Manhattan. Coming up, the man who provided The Graduate with its memorable songs, Paul Simon. This is Fresh Air.
Are you going to Scarborough Fair? Parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme. Remember me to one who lives there.
When director Mike Nichols was assembling a rough edit of The Graduate, he used as a backing track a Simon & Garfunkel recording that had already been released. It wasn't supposed to stay there, but before long, the song seemed too perfect to replace. Terry spoke with Paul Simon in 2000, and he told her about how he wrote that song while he was working at his first job in music.
It was just when I was coming out of college, and they offered to pay me, I think, $150 a week, which seemed like so much money that I really couldn't refuse it. But I was probably never more miserable than doing that. And my job was to go and take the songs that this huge publishing company owned and go around to record companies and to A&R men at record companies and see if any of their artists wanted to record The Peanut Vendor or... which I think was one of their songs or something like that. And I worked for them for, about 6 months maybe. And I never got one song placed. But I did give them a couple of my songs that I was writing because I felt so guilty about taking their...
Which songs?
Their check. Very early songs, I think, like Bleecker Street, maybe some songs that weren't even recorded. And then I got into an argument with them. And I said, look, you know, I quit. I'm out of here. I don't want to work here anymore. And I'm not giving you my new song. And see ya. And the song that I had just written was The Sound of Silence. And I said, I'll just publish this myself. And that's and from that point on, I've owned all of my songs. So that was a lucky argument that I had with this guy.
That's great. What year was it that you took back that song?
It was somewhere around 1963, because I left the country after Kennedy was assassinated. I was very upset about it, and I left and I went to live in England for a while. And it was somewhere around in there.
Now, I'm glad you mentioned Sounds of Silence, because that's, if you had to choose a song that was like a good kind of prototype of young alienation, that would be it, you know? People talking without speaking, people hearing without listening, it just seems to be so much about this kind of youthful alienation. What do you think?
Yes, it's true, but I think about songs that... It's not just what the words say, but it's what the melody says and what the sound says. My thinking is that if you don't have the right sound and you don't have the right melody, it really doesn't matter what you have to say. People don't hear it. They only are available to hear when the sound entrances and makes people open to the thought. And so really the key about the sound of silence, I think, is the simplicity of the melody and the words, which are really, in a sense, well, they're youthful alienation. It's a young lyric, but actually not bad for, you know, a 21-year-old, but... you know, not a sophisticated thought, and not a thought that I, you know, it was a thought that I gathered from somewhere, you know, probably from some, you know, college reading material or something, you know. It wasn't something that I was experiencing and on some deep, profound level. Nobody's listening to me. Nobody listens to anybody. It was a post-adolescent angst, but it had some level of truth to it, and it resonated with, it resonated with millions of people, as it turns out. But I think largely because it had this very simple and singable and memorable melody.
Well, why don't we hear it? And this is Simon and Garfunkel.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping, and the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence. Restless dreams I walked alone, narrow streets of cobblestone, neath the halo of a street lamp. I turned my collar to the cold and damp, when my eyes were stabbed by the flash of a neon light that split the night and touched the sound. Silent, and in the naked light I saw 10,000 people, maybe more, people talking without speaking, people hearing without listening, people writing songs that voices never share. No one did. The sound of silence.
Paul Simon speaking with Terry Gross in 2000. We'll conclude our salute to the 40th anniversary of The Graduate by having our critic at large, John Powers, revisit the film for the first time in 40 years.
I was a sophomore in high school when The Graduate first opened, and I still remember sitting in that Omaha theater and feeling a new kind of thrill wash over me. I'd loved many movies before, but this was the first one that seemed to have been made just for me. In thinking this, of course, I was like millions of others who thought exactly the same thing, which is one reason The Graduate instantly became a touchstone that helped define a whole era. I went to see it again and again during its first run, maybe 10 times in all. But protecting its place in my memory, I didn't watch it again until recently, when I got the 40th anniversary DVD. I popped the disc into the player with trepidation, but from the opening strains of Simon and Garfunkel singing "Hello, Darkness, My Old Friend," I was hooked and relieved. The Graduate still plays like gangbusters. Wonderfully directed by Mike Nichols, it's funny and staged with startling vividness. Back then, Hollywood directors were cribbing great visual ideas from European art movies. No doubt you know the story. A sly, fresh-faced Dustin Hoffman plays Benjamin Braddock, who returns home from college to the L.A. of sunshine and swimming pools. Everybody is pushing him towards a prosperous middle-class future, famously captured in a single word of advice: plastics. But Ben wants something more authentic, and he finds it in the form of Elaine Robinson. That's Catherine Ross, the co-ed daughter of his father's partner. But there's one huge stumbling block. Ben's having an affair with her mother, the worldly alcoholic Mrs. Robinson, played with indelible foxiness by Anne Bancroft, whose crossing and uncrossing legs are as eloquent as any monologue. Her scenes with Ben are modern classics, like this early one, when she invites the naive graduate back to her house, and he starts to panic.
Oh, my God.
Pardon?
Oh, no, Mrs. Robinson, oh, no.
What's wrong?
Mrs. Robinson, you didn't expect...
What?
I mean, you didn't really think I'd do something like that.
Like what?
What do you think?
Well, I don't know.
For God's sake, Mrs. Robinson. Here we are. You got me into your house. You give me a drink. You put on music. Now you start opening up your personal life to me and tell me your husband won't be home for hours.
So?
Mrs. Robinson, you're trying to seduce me. Aren't you?
Watching The Graduate again flooded me with old passions, all that anxious isolation and thwarted romanticism. But I couldn't help noticing things that had escaped my teenage eyes. Despite hitting the zeitgeist, the movie was actually a bit behind the times. Based on a novel from 1963, a different cultural era, really, it celebrates a brand of timid youthful innocence that many of Ben and Elaine's contemporaries were happily shedding. In fact, The Graduate represents a fundamental step in the media's domestication of what we think of as the 60s. The movie came out in the days of civil rights marches, Vietnam protests, and the Summer of Love. But none of these appear here. Even when Ben chases Elaine to Berkeley, ground zero of student radicalism, you get nothing more than shots of picturesque quads and a gruff landlord asking him if he's an agitator. Ben says no, and he's right. You see, he and Elaine are ciphers who don't stand for anything more than a generational rejection of their parents' inauthenticity. It was easy for many of us to project our own vague feelings of alienation onto Ben and Elaine because their rebellion didn't make any demands, didn't confer any responsibilities, didn't prove irrevocable. Their rebel attitudes often looked dangerous or apocalyptic, but in their way, they proved as safely suburban as what we were all rebelling against. Small wonder that so many iconoclastic young boomers like Ben and Elaine would turn into middle-aged bourgeois bohemians. I now grasp that the real outlaw is, of course, Mrs. Robinson, who, caught in the era before women's lib, tries to escape the velvet prison of housewifery in ways that boys like me found very scary. Although she's by far the film's most interesting character, I'd pick her over the bland Elaine anytime. It betrays her by turning her into a petty villain who curses like a fishwife when Ben crashes Elaine's wedding. And we're not supposed to care because The Graduate sides with Ben and Elaine. They're the young ones, and that's what matters. Maybe so, but today she's the character who now feels the most daring, the most unconventional, and the most human. She's the real rebel without a cause. I know I'm saying this 40 years too late, but here's to you, Mrs. Robinson.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews the new Stephen King movie, The Mist. This is Fresh Air. The director Frank Darabont has had good luck in the past adapting the works of Stephen King, first with The Shawshank Redemption, then with The Green Mile. But those were rare King books outside the horror genre. Now he takes on Monsters from the Unknown in The Mist. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
The Mist is a derivative B-horror picture, somehow raised to the level of a primal Scream. All along you think you know what's to come. All along what comes is worse than you think, and fear. The premise is simple, by which I mean both easy to understand and a little feeble-minded. After a violent storm, an artist played by Thomas Jane with a house on a lake in Maine says to his wife, "Hey, honey, you ever seen mist like that on the lake, coming from the direction of that super-secret army lab?" Words to that effect, anyway. The wife says, "No, that is odd." And the husband says, "Oh, well, better take the truck into town and pick up some supplies at the supermarket. See you in a flash." He doesn't see her in a flash. Shortly after he and his young son, played by Nathan Gamble, arrive at the crowded market, a man dashes in like a bat out of hell. No, actually, the bats out of hell arrive later.
Oh, my God.
Something in the mist! Something in the mist!
Damn.
Cook John Lee!
Damn, catch your breath.
Shut the doors! Shut the doors, Micah! Don't go out there. There's something in the mist.
Your reaction to that will either be, ooh, scary, or wow, cheesy. But it's hard to laugh off the thunderous rattling of the market's huge windows, or the eeriness of the silence that follows. The director, Frank Darabont, borrows a lot of Steven Spielberg's visual tropes. The people who melt into and out of the mist recall Close Encounters of the Third Kind. But Spielberg's vision was deeply optimistic. Even his War of the Worlds suggested a fierce commitment to family would help humanity survive an alien onslaught. The Mist is not so sanguine. The idea of a bunch of disparate people trapped in an enclosed space is a wheezy horror staple, and some of the dialogue is predictably clunky. But some of it isn't. Characters with different points of view argue fiercely, and they're all played by great actors. Andre Brower as a city lawyer with a lake house is an obstinate skeptic. Laurie Holden as the new teacher in town argues people are basically good, while an assistant store manager, played by the wonderful Toby Jones, says unstable humans are prone to violence when the going gets tough. There's plenty of evidence to support both sides, but dominating all is the majestic Marcia Gay Harden as the town's religious fanatic. She says the mist is God's vengeance on a secular society for its wicked ways, echoing remarks made by Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson after 9/11. As all kinds of thingies invade, she begins to attract a following, from a rapt young woman to a market butcher complete with knife. The threats are from without and within. The central relationship, though, is between Thomas Jane and his son, who begins to cling desperately to his dad.
It's all right, Big Bill. It won't be gone long. Just next door. We'll be safe.
Daddy, there are things out there. Things.
Yeah, but there's a lot less of them in the daytime.
They'll wait in the mist where you can't see them, and then when you go and can't get back in, they'll come and eat you up. Daddy, don't go!
Usually, kids in genre movies range from stilted to adequate, whereas Nathan Gamble, who played one of the affluent children in Babel, is so credible and intense, it's almost unfair. You can't defend yourself against these scenes, even though you know you probably should. Thomas Jane can be a little wooden, but not here. Opposite Gamble, he has a tragic dimension. I won't spoil the film by describing the creatures. Some betray their computer-generated origins, yet the way the attacks are shot and edited, they have a fury that's biblical. The Mist builds toward a climax so heartbreaking that I hesitate to recommend it. But I think Darabont earns his vision. He touches obliquely on so many of our anxieties in this frightening age. Schisms of class and religion. Fear of the technology's impact on the environment. Fear of God's vengeance, or the vengeance of people on behalf of their God. The Mist is the feel-bad movie of the new millennium. It could be called The Miasma.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. Our digital production project supervisor is Julian Herzfeld. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.
Support for NPR comes from the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont at cabotcheese.coop. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art, now exhibiting drawings by Georges Seurat. More at moma.org. And from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think, by food psychologist Brian Wansink. More at mindlesseating.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, plastics, and foods, electronics, and other household products which contain toxic chemicals. We'll speak with investigative reporter Mark Shapiro, author of Exposed, The Toxic Chemistry of Everyday Products and What's at Stake for American Power. Join us for the next Fresh Air.